Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Does this need to go down a little bit, does it?
Sure. I think it's strong enough.
So what is it? It must be, yeah, maybe it's this one. I think we'll just...
It's okay.
We'll just leave it. I'll just put this here. Okay. That's the best we can do. And this is on?
Yeah, this is...
So we're looking now at... Unit 13. Unit 13, so... And of course this was the first unit of this module 2. So we're going to choose one of these questions. There were four questions for the open book assessment, and we're going to do a revision for the essays, and we're going to look at academic integrity this time, question three, which is: select a text from chapter 4 and explain how it could be misused and explain the fallacy of its misuse. And so we're looking at chapter 4, Canto 4, chapter 4.
Is it any text problem? Or
is it... Well, let's first of all, the first item, of course, is to identify that fallacy. Yeah. To pause this, press the red button. So we've identified a statement which can be utilised in ISKCON as a statement in a fallacious way, in other words, without proper academic integrity. So we'll read that from Canto 4, Chapter 4, Text Number 3. And Srila Prabhupada states in the purport, due to this example of Shiva and Sati, that womanly weakness exists even in the relationship between husband and wife. Generally, separation between husband and wife is due to womanly behaviour. Divorce takes place due to womanly weakness. A wife should not leave her husband's protection because of such a misunderstanding. If she does so, it is understood to be due to her womanly weakness. So we found another statement regarding the divorce issue, the woman's weakness. Something that we'll discuss a little bit further about putting the statement in context. And the statement from verse 7. Women are naturally soft-hearted, men are hard-hearted. There's another very important issue in this chapter we won't be discussing today, but just to bring to your notice, in text number 17, the statements about how one should at all costs not tolerate blasphemy against devotees. And there it discusses, you know, the Kshatriyas should punish the blasphemer by cutting out the tongue. Sudras and Vaishyas should give up their body. And of course, we don't want people who are protecting devotees to be cutting out people's tongues. And we don't want people who are associated with devotees who hear blasphemy to give up their body. And it is important, you know, when these issues are discussed, you know, if someone's giving a class on the Bhagavad Gita and this comes up in the purport, it is important to actually state that we don't want devotees or you know, people associated with devotees doing these extreme activities, that these are activities that, you know, were authorized by government law thousands of years ago, but not now. And certainly they're not in the mood of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So if someone is giving a class and this statement comes up in the purport, you have to be aware that people are listening to the classes, either in the class or at home. And if people are not quite in their right mind, they may do that. Now, I know back in the history of ISKCON, you know, there are cases of devotees committing suicide over certain issues, and you know, so you have to be very careful that there are people who are not thinking things through clearly, and sometimes these statements can set them off to do something. So it's very important that if they come up in a class and they're heard in the purport, that they understand that we are not presenting this as something to do now, as something that may have been done thousands of years ago or previous to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement, is not being advised to do now, but it's showing the seriousness of blasphemy, but that it should not be tolerated. But one has to make those statements to make it very clear to the audience. So, have you found any other statements so far regarding? And of course, this is why we're going to deal with this statement today, as far as academic integrity, divorce takes place due to womanly weakness, because this has been, you know, an issue in ISKCON and still is. When we say an issue, because it's misused by authorities in ISKCON, who don't take seriously, you know, a woman's problems, difficulties that they're having, and by men in this one. Mm-hmm. So it needs to be discussed. Verse 32, yeah. read that part out.
In the present age of Kali, it is not possible to find expert mantra chanters. Therefore, all the sacrifices recommended in the Vedas are forbidden in this age. The only sacrifice recommended in this age is chanting Hare Krishna mantra, because in this age it is not possible to accumulate the needed funds for performing sacrifices, not to speak of finding expert brahmanas who can chant the mantras perfectly.
Yes. Yeah. So, all sacrifices recommended in the Vedas are forbidden in this age. The only sacrifice recommended in this age is the chanting of Hare Krishna mantra, because in this age it is not possible to accumulate the needed funds for performing sacrifices. Mm. Not to speak of finding expert brahmanas who can chant the mantras perfectly. Mm. So, in what way do you feel that that may be misused or...
I mean, some Vedic samskaras may be performed, but people may use this code to say that's not valid.
That's right. In fact, they do. It's one of the things that I've come across a lot, is that what I find interesting is that unless I've personally spoken to a devotee, I find that most of them wonder why I'm performing fire yogis. You know, that basically you have your ISKCON temple activities and then you've got Ganga doing his fire yogis, which are not recommended, you know, in the Sankirtan Buddha. That opinion, you know, seems to... So then, you know, I find that when I speak to someone, they ask me something about yogis, that's usually their opinion. Which surprises me because, you know, I'm thinking, why, you know, I've given different classes where I've explained, but, you know, it seems to be a prejudice which is really hard to get through. They have to hear it personally, you know, and significantly explain to them that we are allowed to do samskaras, that we're not doing, you know, say, Rajasuya Jagya, you know, we're not doing Asvamedha Jagya. We're not doing the Soma Jagya to go to the moon, you know. We're not doing Chattamas Jagya. Even our Chattamas is very, very, you know, simple. You know, no spinach, no yogurt. Next month, no milk like that. Very simple. Chant some extra rounds, you know. And you know, there's not a lot of statements in Prabhupada's books about that, but we have to understand Prabhupada performed fire yajna for initiation. That means a fire yajna, when it is associated with the samskaras, because initiation is a samskara, fire yajna is associated with Vaishnava samskaras is acceptable. He also performed fire yajna with marriage. That's another samskara. Prabhupada points in out his books that, you know, there are many samskaras, but there are 10 principal ones. Following the Sat-Kriya samskara dipika. Sat-Kriya Saradipika, which is Gopala Bhatta Goswami, who is called Smritacharya. I forget the exact term. You know, you have Rasacharya, you know, one of the Goswamis, you know, Bhakti Acharya, you know, like that. They each have different titles that, you know, one discusses the rasa in greater detail, another discusses the rituals, that is, Gopala Bhatta Goswami. So he is a chari of that. They each have their particular forte, their particular portfolio. And he describes how, you know, what is acceptable for Vaishnava samskaras and what is not acceptable within Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement. And you know, one time, you know, one of the few statements I found, which is very important, but sums it up really well. Prabhupada was asked about, you know, what is our position on samskaras and, you know, those sort of purificatory rites. Prabhupada said, yes, we do the minimum. He never said, no, they're forbidden. He said, yes, we do the minimum. We do do them, but we do the minimum. Like that. That's a very clear statement. They're acceptable, keep it to a minimum. Don't do it too, you know. And even in this temple, one of the difficulties I have is trying to convince other devotees who are capable of performing yajnas not to do this showy, elaborate type of yajna for the sake of demonstrating their skills in, you know, assembling so much paraphernalia and setting up some magnificent, you know, artistic yajna kund and so many things. Because what happens is that as soon as we, you know, are not doing, we're doing more than we need to, we are overshadowing the potency of the holy name and the recitation of the Gita and the worship of Krishna as the and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That is where the potency comes from within our samskaras, within our yajnas. And therefore, you know, in Prabhupada's yajnas, very important what he wanted. Chant Hare Krishna. If Prabhupada was doing yajna, when there's a pause, he'd say chant. Everyone would chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. As soon as there's silence for 2 minutes, Prabhupada chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Chanting constantly, that was significant. The other thing was his books. One book in each corner. Nectar Devotion, Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, Chaitanya Charitamrita, representing the four Vedas, the four Brahmanas. We don't need to have four Brahmanas in each corner necessarily. It's good if you have a devotee reading them, but at least the books. We don't need to have the Vedas, we don't need to have all sorts of ribbons and things like that on the books. If the book is there, that's, you know, enough. But Prabhupada's books, not the different Vedic books which are part of that. So, you know, the books, the Hare Krishna Mahamantra and a discussion on from Prabhupada's books about the significance of the ceremony and worship Krishna, then everything is done. As soon as, and you know, we start drawing people's attention away from that and to the paraphernalia assembled, as if that's where the potency is. Or the Vedic mantras being chanted, as if that's where the potency is. We have the authorization to chant Hare Krishna and a few mantras. Not that we rattle off a whole lot of Vedic mantras and minimize the Hare Krishna. We're not authorized to do that. So, you know, and one of the difficulties I see is that, you know, even I see it in this temple that persons who are capable of doing the samskaras, what have you, it's trying to teach them or get within their consciousness to keep that ritualistic side simple, purposely. You know, you purposely fight against Hindus making you do more because they're interested in rituals. We have to fight against that and do less ritual, more Hare Krishna, more Prabhupada's books, more Gita. We actually have to fight against becoming Hindus. You know, we want to do it as close to Prabhupada's way. And therefore, and what happens is sometimes, you know, some devotees are doing something and the Hindu connection is saying, we want this, we've got to have that, the wood's got to be mango wood, they've got to be, you know, mango leaves, they've got to be this, you've got to have that, you tie a string around my arm, do this, do that. And they just, the list goes on for hours. You know. So it is an issue, and it, you know, as far as I can see, it's an issue that will become, especially now, because you know we have devotees learning from the Mayapur Institute how to do yajnas and different things. But you know, if you take some of those personalities out of India and drop them in the West, then do they understand the preaching methods of the Sankirtan which override everything we do? You know, our Sankirtan mood, even, you know, is the flavor of our deity worship. It's the flavor of our Rath Yatra. You know, it's the flavor of our, everything we do is flavored predominantly by the Sankirtan mood. There was one Indian gentleman, he was here a little while ago, the last couple of years he's come a few times, bald head, little pot belly. But he was a Brahmana from India, and he told me, one day I was doing a yagya. I knew he and his family had been doing yagyas for many generations. And he came and sat down beside me one time, and I felt a little embarrassed because I know I do things quite simply. But I was instructed to by my spiritual master to, first thing he said, not too many mantras. The main instruction, not too many mantras. And anyway, he sat there and I thought, oh, you know, he's going to watch me and see what. And I said, oh, you know, something like, you know, I do things very simply. He said, oh, no, I've come to sit and learn. And I was really surprised by that. Because I know that he does that. That's his, that's what he does in India. He does yagyas only. And his father's done that all his life. And his father did that all his life, like that. And I said, you know, I don't understand, you know, why you are. He said, in India, people are losing interest because we have so much time, nothing is explained to them. It takes hours to do anything, and people just losing interest by the thousands. He said, I have watched you do yagyas. He said, you're doing everything. But you do it simply, but everything is there, and it's very attractive like that. And he said, I want to learn that and do that. So I was very happy with that, you know. And coming from him, that it really meant something. So, but I did, you know, I studied the Satkriya Saradipika for months, plus the Vaishnava handbook and all the Prabhupada's lectures, anything related to yagyas. I did that not because I was doing yagyas, but because in case I ever did do yagyas. So this is long before I ever did yagyas. And strange enough, when I went to New South Wales, and my wife got initiated by Indrajumna Swami. He gave her initiation. He was staying in a room in Sydney. And he had his Radha Krishna deities, his Radha Vallabha as well, I think, who'd been worshipped 100 years in Vrindavan, I think, some have given. So, no fire jagya, but he accepted the her vows and gave her name and the beads like that. And that was the ceremony. And he said to me, when you get back to Melbourne, you do the yagya. Which come out of the blue, because I had never done a yagya before, nor had I asked about it, nor had I even mentioned to anyone that I was, you know, really studying it. But as I've always said, if you study something properly, Krishna will give you the opportunity and reward you with a service where you can utilize the time that you spent. It never goes wasting. So anyway, I came back and, you know, I had been studying and, you know, I presented some of my studies to the devotees who were doing yagyas and they couldn't understand. They obviously had never read anything. I said, I've written this and I've got this order and these. And they'd never, you know, they just, someone had shown them a couple of things that they really didn't understand, although they were doing it. So, but I understood, you know, from what I had studied, that I was including everything. I made sure that there's nothing there that I'm not including, but I reduced everything to the bare minimum. In other words, that if I do this, these three things are included, like that. So I reduced like that. And I made sure everything was in the correct order according to the proper etiquette. So he noticed, he said, you're doing everything, but, you know, It's very, very simply, but everything is there, like that. So I was very happy with that. But trying to explain that even to other ISKCON devotees is very difficult. And they have this mood that, one, either you shouldn't be doing them at all. Like, why do you do that? Is that, you know, everyone else is chanting Hare Krishna. And, you know, I said to one person, even though they see me in the courtyard, if you see me in the courtyard doing yajna, I'm chanting Hare Krishna with them, I'm reading a verse of the Gita with them, and they're offering obeisance to the Shalagram Shila. And no one seems to notice that. They just see me doing the fire yajna, and they think, what are you doing? And I say to them, every person that comes to me, I get them to chant Hare Krishna, I get them to hear a verse from the Gita, and they offer the obeisances to Krishna. And they go, oh yeah. And if I didn't do the ceremony, they wouldn't do that. If we weren't doing the samskara, they would not come to ISKCON and do those things. They would go to a Hindu temple, do a samskara, no chanting, no Gita, no offering obeisances to Krishna. So what is the benefit? So what is the harm of that? But, you know, it's, as I say, I've mentioned these things in Srimad Bhagavatam class, but it's really hard to get through the heads of devotees of what's actually happening and what a valuable preaching tool it is. Usually what anyway, I won't go too far on that, but, you know, it's a good point there, Naveen, that it is actually... a controversial issue which is taken out of context. So, you know, so there's a couple we found there. I'll write that on the board as well, just for reference. Can and should. Vedic samskaras. What, you know, we call a fire yajna. Can't be done in ISKCON. Most definitely. One of the best preaching tools that we have. So I can have a chat with you after class about that, yeah, the text. And I was going to send a text to your husband, but I didn't get a chance to. But yeah. So, I haven't yet. No. But Sri Mata will let me know. I haven't yet. So. Any other sections in chapter 4 of Canto 4 related to this top statement here? Divorce takes place due to womanly weakness. If not, let's begin our discussion on that. So, three very significant issues in this chapter, which can be misquoted even by ISKCON devotees, not to speak of others not very well acquainted with ISKCON. The question of Vedic samskaras being dumped in along with Vedic sacrifices which are forbidden. If one takes that stance, then we should not do marriages and we should not do initiations because they're Vedic yajnas. But because they're Vaishnava samskaras, they are part of our Sankirtan movement along with other significant samskaras. But as Prabhupada said, yes, they're done to a minimum. And, you know, if something is as with you know, initiation. Sometimes you know, some of the ritual is done in a very simple way, or a slightly unusual way. But we consider, because the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is there, the connection with Krishna is there through the parampara. Prasadam is distributed, etc. The Vedic philosophy, you know, the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Bhagavad Gita taught people that even though parts of the rituals are not done at the exact time, or sometimes not at all, or sometimes in an unusual way, it doesn't affect us, because we understand that there are considerable concessions in the Sankirtan movement, where everything is considered perfect because the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is there. A very important statement in the 8th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam about that, that, you know, when the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is there, the holy names of the Lord are chanted, then it's considered all mantras done, all ritual done. And that's, you know, so as I've given the example with my wife's initiation, that, you know, just the vows were accepted in front of Radha Krishna. You know, one may say, you know, when I got back to Melbourne, I didn't actually do that yoga, because despite all my studies, I always felt unqualified, or, you know, I didn't feel, I thought it would be a big imposition for me to actually do one, you know. So I even though I had the instruction from a spiritual master, I didn't feel that I was qualified. So one time Tejan Rita Swami was there, and he was doing the yoga for his disciples. And I said to, I think it was Nandamaraj, can you ask Maharaj if my wife can sit in on the yajna, because, you know, she just hasn't had that 5 path. He was in the yajna, he saw her sitting in there, his eyes, you know, he wasn't sure whether it might initiate her. but I don't think someone explained it to him properly. But that was the yajna, so I never actually did it. But the thing is, what happens when there's a fire yajna? Is you get Krishna to witness the activities. So, when my spiritual master gave her the mantras and accepted her vows, who was there? Radha Krishna, his deities. There is no difference at all between, you know, accepting the vows in front of Radha Krishna in the form of a deity, and accepting the vows in front of a fire. There's no difference. It's the same Krishna. And if someone distinguishes that, oh, well, Krishna's not there, he didn't do the fire, then what is their Krishna consciousness? You know? There's something very foolish about that. So, you know, there are, in ISKCON, not always the exact ritual is done, but the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is there, Krishna is there, spiritual master is there, you know, we're quite satisfied. My initiation, you know, my Guru Maharaj was in Poland, you know, I accepted, you know, the, you know, when I got re-initiated, the vows over the phone, into the right ear, across thousands of miles, and got re-Brahman as well. One main question, you know, oh, are you even a disciple? You know, the last 2 times I've seen my spiritual master, he's told me personally, he said, you know, amongst all my disciples, you're in the top 10. So, you know, there's no question. So, you know, it's very strange that some statements like this, you know, regarding fire yajnas and samskaras are so misquoted, but that does happen to this very day, even in our own temple. You know, here there's other statements, blasphemy against the bodies. As we said, we don't want people cutting out other people's tongues. We don't want people giving up their bodies. Sometimes these things happen for someone who's a little unhinged in their mind. People may take that, and devotees have to be very careful when they're reading these statements. Now, we're going to look at this, which is a big issue. Divorce takes place due to womanly weakness. Now, that is something which is, again, rampantly misused, misquoted, without proper academic integrity. Let's look at that. Academic and moral integrity. What do we do to do something without academic and moral integrity?
Yep.
What do? We take things out of context? What other things can we do? You know, how do we expose? You know, when something's presented in a fallacious way, something's presented and there's a fallacy to how it's being presented. How do we expose that? What are people, you know, it's out of context, that's one thing that's being done. What else would they do? What else can you do?
They use a statement to justify their motivation.
Yes, so, you know, it's lack of moral integrity, so... you know, there's a justifying bad behaviour or bad morals. Yeah? What about quoting part of the text? You know, leaving bits out. Part of the text, so out of context would be with the can be with the particular chapter, but it can also be out of context with Prabhupada's mood. It can be out of context with other statements and other, you know, parts of the Bhagavad Gita. So out of context, you know, can be done in various different ways. Let's say, you know, disregarding the big picture, you know, or disregarding... You know, Srila Prabhupada's main teachings. And mood.
You know, if someone were to suggest that
time and time again, whenever, you know, there was a problem in an Iskcon marriage, that Prabhupada would go straight for the woman, oh, it's all your fault. If someone was to suggest that, they would be presenting a falsity, because that's not the case. So,
you know,
so what is the false statement that may be taken here? What, you know, how would that be wrongly presented? We, you know.
What is the part of text?
Which one?
Part of text. So what do you mean by that?
Ah, part of the text. Right, so in other words, out of context... means that
sometimes they may quote half the sentence.
sometimes they may tell half the story. You know, there's one I'll give you an example. I spoke this one in class, and I probably ruffled a few feathers. Yeah, I did. I went up to reception one day, and you know, they used to have this thing where there's a thought for the day. And it's got a little quote from Prabhupada. People come into the temple, devotees come into reception, and they had that high thing. So it's about, you know, it's the first thing you see, and they look at the quote. And the quote was, you know, something like, anyone who takes advice from astrologers is a fool, something like that. I was shocked. I was so shocked that that got in as one of Prabhupada's main quotes, that we should meditate in ISKCON. And I gave class in it. And I was saying, who's the fool, who's the rascal, who put that there? Who authorised that? You can imagine I ruffled a few feathers, because I know who authorises everything. But I could not believe it. I still can't believe it. What is the story that goes with that? Right? Completely out of context. How do you think, you know, how would I feel as a practicing astrologer where I get the gurus asking me to do astrology for their disciples and this, that and the other? I'm accepted all over the world. Some of the Maharajas won't do something until their disciples have confirmed with me that it's okay and I've checked it. And they say, I will not give permission for you to do this until you check the Gandhi. And in this temple, I'm laughed at as a fool because of the quotes that they put on the desk. So, what is the story? The story goes, you know, it's connected to, you know, someone asked Prabhupada something about astrology, told this story that, you know, one time someone was sitting on the end of a branch, and they were cutting the branch while they were sitting on it, and someone walked past and said, if you keep cutting that branch, you'll fall off, because you're sitting on the wrong side, the part that's going to fall. Oh, yeah, you can tell the future, you know, don't be like that. First walked off. Anyway, he keeps cutting, he falls down, bangs his head, hurts himself, and he says, oh my goodness, that person could tell the future, he's a great sadhu. And he went and said, oh, you're a great mystic yogi. Oh, why is that? Because you can tell the future. You can see that I was going to fall off. So Prabhupada said, you know, someone who takes advice from astrologers like that is a fool. What does that mean? That means, why go to an astrologer when something should be so obvious to you, you don't need an astrologer? That's what it means. You have all the Prabhupada Srimad Bhagavatams, and most of the time you should know what to do. Why go to an astrologer when you're going to avoid the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam? That's what it means. Prabhupada tells another story. Let's put it into context. Prabhupada told this story, which was not quoted on the back of that thing that I was looking at. Prabhupada says, you know, in the Bhagavatam, several times, astrology is a great science. It's misused, does not make it useless. And discussing that point with his disciples, he told this story that, you know, in his family, they were connected to one very, very well-known established doctor. One time this doctor, you know, he had a very good reputation with Prabhupada's family. He was a very intelligent, significant personality. But one time he was treating a patient who had this very, very difficult problem with the throat, and it affected his eating. The person was sort of losing his health and could potentially die. The doctor said to him, because he wasn't getting cured by his treatment, I want you to see an astrologer. So he went to the astrologer, and the astrologer said, the doctor is treating you for this, but you actually have this problem. He went back to the doctor and told the doctor, and the doctor said, the astrologer said, I have this problem. He treated for that and he was cured. And that's the story Prabhupada tells to verify the validity of astrology. That some things which can't be seen otherwise can only be seen by astrology. So when he says that someone who goes to an astrologer is a fool, it means that if you take it like that, if you've got no common sense and you have to go to an astrologer, that's not the path. Try and develop some common sense. You know? If you can't read Prabhupada's books and get some information from that, you've got to get it all from an astrologer, don't do that either. That's not what this one's about. But if there are some things which can only be seen through astrology, do that. Okay? Now that's the context in which most of Prabhupada's statements are made. And to put something, you know, like that on a thing where people come in is justifying vilification of a devotee using astrology, you know, within the temple as if don't listen to anything that person says. It's justification of bad morals. Everyone knows I'm an astrologer. Everyone knows at some stage I'd walk into that reception and see that. And one time, my wife, she was sitting next to some devotees and she overheard about this time. They had seen this. And they were discussing, they were laughing amongst themselves, talking about how, about that quote and how people who go to astrologers are fools and they're laughing their heads off at how ridiculous, you know, that is. And she was sitting there, so right next to them, they're offending the wife of an astrologer. So this is bad morals, justifying bad behaviour, lack of academic moral integrity, like that. So, you know, these things go on. What to speak of astrology, imagine how much this one's going to cause this kind of trouble. You know, divorce takes place due to womanly weakness. You know, it's something that needs to be dealt with very carefully. So, here are some of the ways that academic and moral integrity can be revealed. Because one of the things in the essay is you want to discuss that. Here's a statement. When there's some of these different things, you know, academic and moral integrity is compromised. And what would be the statement if it was? What would be the statement that, you know, the wrong statement would be, whenever there's divorce, it's always the woman's fault. To put it bluntly. That's what, you know, where it comes down to. Venus, that's a woman. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus. That would be the fallacious or
fallacious statement.
Due to lack of academic and moral integrity, which would cause a lot of problem to women and ISKCON.
Or to speak of the devotee who creates that sort of an offence to the Vaishnavis in ISKCON. It would be a very offensive statement to all the Vaishnavis in ISKCON. Any woman, any devotee woman in ISKCON who understood that a man was speaking in those terms would be offended by that man. And that's Vaishnava apparat. In the same way, I was offended by that, you know, the way that they're portraying, you know, myself, obviously, as a fool.
Is it a handwritten one or?
What's that?
That text, was it a handwritten one or?
No, it was just, it was with quotes from Prabhupada. You know. They took part of a sentence out of context and presented it as a significant thought that we should be meditating upon in ISKCON or anywhere.
Prabhu, they lose a lot on Facebook.
Yeah.
A lot. Mm. Just isolating statements like what you're putting and judging people.
Exactly.
A lot.
I first saw the Facebook, wanted to put people put a few statements on, there's something about vegetarianism or something. Someone quoted something and I presented, that's out of context, and I presented Prabhupada's verse. Someone else then countered with another fallacious statement which I countered from Prabhupada's books, and then someone else. And I realised, what you're saying, it goes on forever. The people are just going to misquote Prabhupada's books forever. So, unless you can actually properly sit down with those people and have a significant statement, a conversation, until it's properly resolved, they just keep quoting fallacious statements on the internet. So I just, never again, I've never ever commented on anyone's statement. No matter what they say or how ridiculous, I do not get involved. It is a useless waste of time on the internet. Unless I can sit down and discuss with them, I will not get involved. Even I know the answer.
Well, how far back was that?
It was years and years ago. No, when my wife first put on Facebook. I don't use it. She tells me things. You know, we're lying in bed at night and she'll, you know, put the Facebook thing and she'll tell me all the things that are going on and she'll ask my opinion on, and every now and then she'll ask me, you know, can I comment, and we'll discuss a comment and she'll put something. That's hard to get.
No problem, I'm referring to the astrology bit.
That was, I think, about 2 years ago.
Oh, 2 years ago.
I'm still angry about it.
Of course.
I think because of that, they reduced the amount of classes I did, because I mentioned it in class. So, anyone's wondering? So, whenever there is
actually, Banaswami Maharaj, he has taken classes in the farm on astrology.
Mm. Yeah.
Senior Maharaj. So then it is actually mocking at him too.
It's mocking. That's what, again, what I was angry at.
Yeah.
How dare they mock
Banaswami Maharaj? Not only the singer about astrology, he is teaching astrology to the devotees.
Yeah. And Paladananda Maharaj, Paladananda Swami, great astrologer. In one statement, Prabhupada says all of our acharyas were great astrologers.
Bhakti
Siddhanta Saraswati. Yeah, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, he did Krishna's astrology chart and you know, everything. You can look at Krishna's astrological chart, you calculate Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur.
No, but why is a senior Maharaj want to teach it to devotees
if it's such a ridiculous
one? See,
exactly.
One is you're doing the astrology job,
yeah.
But actually teaching, having a session, separate session for devotees, I'll teach you the basics of astrology.
Yeah.
Why should you do it?
Which invokes another big question. If the person who authorized such a misquoted, out of context statement, which could be offensive to astrologers, and those persons themselves are using astrologers regularly outside of the temple, it means they have an issue with an astrologer in the temple.
Mm.
So, I don't know who authorised it, but I'm sure the people who authorise it know themselves. So, all I know is I was doing the best classes after that one. So, divorce takes place due to womanly weakness. Let's have a look at how that may properly be discussed. Yeah. So, I'll flip the board over. Does anyone need to take some notes on that? Or you can do it after class if you like, or you can. Yeah, that's right. Or you I'll leave it there.
So, Prabhu, which means the classes, Srimad Bhagavatam classes have been monitored, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because someone would have listened to your class and the feedback would have gone, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
From the way you're saying it's interesting. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
The person would have come for the class.
I find that there are issues, there are some things in the Bhagavatam which you're just speaking the philosophy, but if there's someone within a temple, not necessarily this one, who is doing the wrong thing, they become a little paranoid about it. So for instance, if you say you come across a verse which describes the other day I gave a class about there should be protection of devotees within a temple and it should be done properly. Protection means that the persons protecting the devotees are not eager for violence. Two, the protection means that they're qualified, they're under the guidance of devotees to protect the devotees, understanding our mood in the Sankirtan movement. We're very tolerant, but at the same time, we do not ever want devotees to be in danger. Not physically, not sexually, not emotionally. If that's not part of the temple policy, then it appears that I'm criticising temple management. So sometimes there are things that just need to be discussed because they're literally in that verse. I'll give you an example of what happened to me one time. This palm tree out here, right, is still here. They were going to cut that down. Certain devotee who does a lot of maintenance came with a chainsaw ready to cut it down. They had permission. I asked, when I heard about that, I asked Munichari, who was an arborist, is that tree a problem to this temple or to the fence? Because it was being claimed that the tree pushed the fence over. He said no. He said neither that building is in trouble and nor that fence. It was really the dirt, not the roots pushing. But it was being said that it was the tree had to go. That tree would have netted the temple about $10,000. You pick them up and you sell it. I said to Munichari, what's the chance of that tree surviving if it's cut out and sold? He said about 50%. They don't always live. And several devotees asked me, please don't let that tree be cut down. And my wife and I organised a kirtan, and we did a kirtan around the tree to bring attention to it. People ask us, why are you doing that? Because you're going to cut it down. And then it became known in the temple that there was an issue. And the wife of the person who's going to cut it down has never spoken to me this day, because it gave her husband, who was going to cut it down, she thought, oh, that's given him a bad name. To this day, she won't talk to me. And that morning, I gave class. And what do you think the purport was? There's a verse in the 10th canto which describes the tree in the Vrindavan courtyard and how it was looked after, it's special, that not, you know, you can look after the tree. I gave a class on all the quotes about how Prabhupada become angry, even trimming branches and cutting trees and so many things. You know, like in Sydney one time, there was a tree that hung over the path as you walked into the door. Next time you came, they cut it down. Prabhupada was so angry. He said, Prabhupada got in your way as you walked in. He said, that's your Western mentality. You know, just cut it down. Of that. You know, he was angry. You know, leave it there, I'll walk around sort of thing. So I gave a class on trees because that was in the purport. But, the difficulty is you can't say everything that needs to be said. Because if you do, it'll be the last time you give a class. So, which is why you don't hear me giving many classes. Especially festivals, especially if there's many people there. Because I've given a few classes like that and some people don't like it. So, my service to Prabhupada comes first. And that is, his books should be what Prabhupada would like to say and what he means to be said in the proper context, in a way that is pleasing to Prabhupada. It is my service, it is your service, it is the service of every devotee in ISKCON to ensure that Prabhupada's books are not neglected, misquoted, taken lightly. Someone is speaking their own philosophy and saying, this is Prabhupada, just like they do with Krishna. Prabhupada says, let Krishna speak for himself. You're speaking your own philosophy and saying it's Krishna's. Let Krishna speak and see what he actually says. And same with Prabhupada. You're speaking your own nonsense and saying it's Prabhupada's philosophy. Or Prabhupada's philosophy, all astrologers are fools. That's your own nonsense. Let Prabhupada speak for himself. He has so many nice statements. So that is the duty of everyone. Not everyone takes it seriously in Bhakti by Bhava. You have to, because if you do Bhakti Shastra, you do Bhakti by Bhava, it means that people will see you as an authority on the true statements and mood of Prabhupada. It becomes an onus upon you to properly represent Prabhupada. Because people will look at you more seriously, that what you say, they'll take more seriously because you've done the course. And therefore, for me to allow academic and moral integrity to be rampant among students is unquestionable. So, let's have a look at how this statement would be, if you were giving a class on this, what are some of the things that you would say? So, we had that statement there that women are naturally soft-hearted, men are hard-hearted. Let's start with that one. Hey, Krishna. Okay, so we're just finding as many statements as we can to verify Prabhupada's statement, his teachings in the Bhagavad Gita, that whenever there's a horse, it's always a woman's problem. Fault. Would you like to add to that?
Hot. Inside
and out. Yeah. Canto 4, chapter 4, text number 3. Have a look at it. See what you think. Alright, no.
There are always exceptions, isn't it?
No, we're trying to debunk that false presentation of Prabhupada.
But there are always exceptions,
no?
Yeah.
There's the odd exception.
Yeah. Exceptions.
No. Women are naturally soft-hearted. Do you think that that's a contentious statement? Do you think that? Let's ask the women.
What percentage of soft-hearted?
That can appear as partial, actually.
What's that?
It can appear as a bit of partiality.
soft-hearted women. Would you say women naturally soft-hearted?
Naturally,
is that upset?
They're meant to be. Naturally. What percentage we don't.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
That's all right? Okay.
No, men are taking up exception to it, Prabhu, from the remarks.
The men are taking exception.
Yeah, they're saying.
They don't agree.
The remarks are coming, they're taking exception.
So we reverse the state.
Prabhu, I'd be happy if I know what percentage soft-hearted.
What
percentage?
Well, you know, the percentage in a woman, or the percentage in the whole population?
Soft-hardness.
2% soft-hardness in each woman, is that what you're saying? So, alright, from our very authoritative poll, or, you know, the consensus of all the women in ISKCON, represented by our women in this class, we will say that that statement is acceptable.
It also depends on what the Eastern, Western.
Yes.
So there are variables, right? So
Eastern,
you know,
women are like an acceptable.
Yeah. So
Western women. Because
so
I don't know.
Let's say there are variables, but the statement, you know, holds true, right?
Men are sometimes very hard-hearted.
Sometimes.
So that's why, no, I thought there is something there.
Is that something?
Sometimes, yes. That's true.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Sometimes.
Only sometimes. Very rarely.
Sometimes.
Once a day, that's okay.
I might just highlight that sometimes with a neon light. No. Variables, so the variable state, there's variables within the statement, but the statements are acceptable. Okay. Overall. Now, you know, that's sort of a general background which helps to put the statement in context. You know, we've got other issues to deal with. One, womanly weakness. And so,
what is but statement?
True overall.
Yeah, so here's the statement. Women are naturally soft-hearted, men are sometimes very hard-hearted. There are obviously variables according to race, age, individuals. But overall, that statement tends to hold true. You know, women tend to accept it, men tend to accept it. Yeah? That soft-hearted nature within a woman varies within each woman and sometimes within groups. Okay. Professions. Now, age. So they're the variables. So note those variables. Is it womanly weakness? Does that soft-hearted nature of a woman sometimes, can it be sometimes presented as a, you know, as a weakness, as something that, you know, the soft-hearted nature of a woman may work against their benefit or against it?
weakness in terms of physical weakness?
No, no, the soft-hearted nature.
Momentary weakness.
What's that?
The weakness is in terms of physical or?
No, in terms of emotion. No, soft-heartedness. Can, you know, would it be wrong to say that sometimes the soft-hearted nature of a woman works against their benefit? Sometimes. Yeah.
Not the soft-hearted nature, but the womanly weakness always goes against their...
But what is that weakness? You know, we're generally associating it with that soft-hearted nature. So in other words, if you just say weakness, it's like women have got a fault. When you say they have a soft-hearted nature, it's their good quality. You know, it's what makes them a woman. You know, like if you say, you know, a tiger is very ferocious, it's not a fault. That's what makes him a tiger.
Yeah.
You see. So, when you use the word weakness, it can indicate a fault.
Mm-hmm.
But Prabhupada's really referring to the soft-hearted nature.
Mm-hmm.
So that you know. So in other words, if you know, if people refer to women as the weaker sex, that would offend people, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would offend women. If you say women are generally soft-hearted, it's not offensive. But it's actually what Prabhupada's talking about, as it's a weakness when sometimes it causes them harm.
Yeah.
Right? So, therefore, you know, one, to understand when Prabhupada's talking about womanly weakness, he's saying that sometimes their soft-hearted nature can make them vulnerable. A weakness in the sense of vulnerable.
Yeah.
Right? To things going a bit wrong. Right? So, you know, vulnerable. You know, if you say a woman is vulnerable, that also is generally acceptable and not offensive. You say women are weak, you know, the Vaishnavis might start throwing flowers at you. Or gulabjamas if they're really angry. But, so, you know, you know, it's sort of moving away from, you know, in a very plain language, we can just say it's a weakness. Very plain language. You know, it is. It's just very, Prabhupada would speak very plainly. That's a very plain word, it's a weakness. Be careful of that. That's a weakness, you know.
It is there in Bhagavad.
Yeah.
Draupadi, yes.
Draupadi,
when Ashwatthama is coming, and
yeah,
she says that she was soft after she could not. In fact, Prabhupada makes a statement clearly.
Yeah.
That's the woman's
weakness.
Prabhupada says,
yeah,
that.
That's right. We have the examples of Draupadi, and you know, we're also discussing here this example of Sati.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
and also, Dipi.
Yeah, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that Prabhupada, sorry, what was that?
She wanted to avenge the death of her sons?
Yes,
that's
right.
That's not weakness, no?
That's an emotional involvement.
It's the same thing we're talking about.
His son knows, so his
son soft-heartedness, vulnerability, plain language weakness. Right? Now, what Prabhupada draws from this is very important. That even amongst the most elevated woman, the same tendency is there. Amongst the strongest, most powerful women, the same tendency is there. Right? A very important point.
Now, if a man in ISKCON were to feel themselves superior because all women are weak, because Prabhupada says that in Bhagavatam, that means that that man has proudly placed himself above Dravi, above Sati, above Diti, and above a multitude of very exalted personalities. And that is obviously not Prabhupada's intention to promote men to such an elevated position due to their pride. That would be a that's if someone, you know, takes that statement, I'm a man, women are weak, I'm stronger, I'm better than women, they're weaker, then they would, you know, somehow they jump above Draupadi, Sati, Deity, Lakshmi, Radharani. So it's obviously not Prabhupada's intention to make that statement. And therefore this statement is one of the prime ways that that mentality is defeated.
So we should remember that even among the most powerful,
that, you know, we accept women as weak. They have this weakness. You know, we look at women as, you know, oh, they have this womanly weakness. You're a woman, you have the womanly weakness. It's said in the Bhagavatam. Oh, what is that womanly weakness? Oh, that means that personalities like Sati and Draupadi, you know, we'll look at them as weak personalities. You know, that's not our philosophy at all. So therefore, this statement, because it says, you know, in the question, it asks you, so we're looking at Unit 13, question 3. Select the text from chapter 4 and explain how it could be misused. Explain the fallacy of its misuse.
Prabhu, can we also mention the same context? Then what about men who wanted to become women to associate with the Lord? Sages,
yeah,
and Lord Rama had come through. They wanted to become, they want to marry Lord Rama. And they, in the next day, they got an opportunity to become the gopis.
Okay. And therefore, you know, it's a good point, because that statement reveals the same thing, that actually, you know, to become more elevated spiritually, great sages, men, have wanted to be promoted to the platform of women. To become more, you know, to take a position of greater spiritual elevation. So rather than the sages in the forest, to become close intimate associates with the Lord. And to do that, they had to take birth in the womb. So
that statement actually defeat that weakness bit?
It defeats the false aspect of weakness.
Yeah. Sages wanting to take more as women.
In other words, to be a female devotee, there's no fault in that at all. There's no faults. There's no... What to speak of being a female devotee? That there's no fault. There's no question of seeing fault. Lord Brahma asks, let me take birth even as an insect or a piece of grass. So, and in that there's no fault. Within the home of a devotee, Bhaktivinoda Kaur said, let me take it, you know, just be an insect in the home of a devotee, and there's no fault in that. And somehow we might see some fault that someone is a woman and they're a Vaishnava. There's something, you know, insects have a nature, grass has a nature, women have a nature, men have a nature. On the spiritual platform, these material, external material situation, does not hamper one's spiritual status.
Prabhu, why once Prabhupada mentioned about the brain substance in men and women, how does, I mean, I don't know if that's a, that's not quite relevant to this here, or can we use that? How do we dispute that?
Yeah, so, Prabhupada uses that argument. And he did mention that example a few times when he discussed it. Certainly caused a lot of controversy, but he dealt with it very nicely. But on the material platform, the women's liberation movement, so men and women are equal. And Prabhupada counters that by saying a couple of things. One, men can't have babies. So on the material platform, women are trying to be equal to men. Women don't need to be equal with men in order to be nicely situated. Nor can they actually become equal with men, because men can't have babies. Men can never become equal with women. Women can never become equal with men. On the material platform, it is just not possible. And to debunk that first, before you get to the spiritual aspect, first you have to debunk that philosophy. So, here we're talking about the spiritual situation of women in ISKCON and devotees in general. If we apply this philosophy to the wider world, they're not within ISKCON, you'll come across this argument that women want to be equal with men. And Prabhupada first had to counteract that. Before you discuss the spiritual aspect, let's get that straight. Men can't have babies. The size and weight of women's brain is less. And
says
Prabhu that Vaishya,
Sudra, and
Brahmin
are less
intelligent than material level. Yeah, he does. Because, you know, he very clearly says that, you know, that there's higher intelligent, less intelligent. You know, Krishna makes a very firm distinction. They're not equal. They think in different ways. One has a greater capacity to use their intelligence and others don't. One thing is that sometimes
I think it's well known to everyone that whether men or women, when the emotions are too prominent within one's heart, they overwhelm the clear thinking of the intelligence. Now that applies to men and women. If women are more soft-hearted, means that they quite often can be influenced by the emotional state within the heart. That's what soft-hearted means. That they take, you know, very receptive to tend to the emotions within the heart, the emotional side of something. That's called soft-hearted. Hard-hearted means the emotions are there, you don't care about it. You don't care about the emotional aspect of something. Something else, the practical aspect of it. That's what hard-hearted refers to here. Soft-hearted means that sometimes the emotional side of an event will eclipse one's intelligence. And what happens that, you know, not only within men and women is there a difference, but also between, you know, Brahmins, you know, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, the Sudras, and women. You know, there is a difference in. It's not saying that women are less intelligent, but if the soft-hearted nature of a woman overrides her intelligence, that makes their intelligence vulnerable, creates a weakness, and at that point they will become less intelligent in general than men who tend not to allow that emotional side. If men allow the emotional side to override their intelligence, they have the same vulnerability and weakness as what is being pointed out in women in general.
But is that hardness or is that hard-heartedness?
No. If men are too soft-hearted, means they allow the emotional aspect of something to override their intelligence, they have the same fault that we find in women. So what we're saying is it's there in men and women, but this as a whole gender, women, you know, it's accepted that women, you know, generally have that tendency more to men, just overall generally. And that the understanding is amongst the women, there's some very hard-hearted women, meaning, not that they're hard-hearted mean, although some are, but what it means is they don't allow their intelligence to be eclipsed by the emotional issue at hand. And among men, there are many who do, see? So it's not saying, so, you know, these are the variables. So, just like tigers. Tigers are ferocious. Bears are ferocious. But there are examples where bears will come up and cuddle some family of humans and roll around and play with them. Only that family. They'll just come wild out of the thing, they attach themselves to family, and they just play like a pet, little pet rabbit. Wouldn't harm anyone else. Tearing to pieces. Tigers, lions, all sorts. A very famous history. I saw a documentary on it previously. Very famous documented cases, you know. So, tigers are ferocious, bears are ferocious, but sometimes, amongst ferocious animals, they cuddle and kiss human beings. You see? So, there's variables among men and women. But we can say generally, we talk about tigers, we talk about them being vicious. That doesn't mean every individual, you know, they're variables. Right? So, but we can't, what happens is when someone takes a variable and makes it the standard across the board. That's the problem. One tiger was, you know, very affectionate to, you know, some humans. All tigers should be known as affectionate from this day on. It's an offence to tigers. I've seen a tiger who, you know, I saw them in the news. All tigers, how dare you say that? We see one, you know, woman who never allows her emotions
to influence her intelligence. All women should be designated like that from now on. Because there's a general rule, and we should, you know, apply it. And we should also apply the variables. And there's a lot of different ways where the variables overlap. But never lose sight of the standard, the norm. That's the beauty of the Bhagavad Gita, is that you get the norm and then you can see the variables. But if you don't have the norm, you're lost. And what is one way you get lost? That men, you know, women will become equal to men. Okay, so for that, men will have to have babies, and they will have to change the size and weight of each other's brains. And then they're equal. So we'll do a few operations on the men's brain, cut a little bit off here and there, at that, and perhaps do some other operations so they can have babies. We're now equal, blah, blah, blah. Not going to happen. But I'm sure they're trying. So, how's the time?
It's half past
4:40.
4:40. Yeah. Alright, so we've got some really good points here. One, we've got some norms, which we always got to... You present that. You know, here's the norm. There are variables, such as this, like that, which is understood. But, you know, the norm... So you sort of... You have to verify the norm, by example, verify the example, the variables by examples, but they don't override the norm generally, and, you know, debunk the fallacious statement that when there's divorce, it's a woman's fault due to her womanly weakness. Take the nastiness out of womanly weakness. That we're really talking about not a fault or a weakness, you know, in that sense. I mean, that's plain language, but really, you know, a tendency that women may sometimes allow their emotions because they have an emotional connection, a soft-heartedness, you know, an affectionate, you know, relationship to the events and the people and their living entities, more so sometimes than men. In fact, to say that women are soft-hearted means that men have the fault, if you want to take it in that way. What is that? They don't give the, you know, they don't have the proper emotional empathy for other humans and other living entities. That's a fault. So they both have their qualities. You can call it a fault, which is... it's a fault when somehow or another... It becomes a fault when one's behaviour becomes incorrect as a result of it. Right? It's seen as a weakness when, if a woman's soft-heartedness creates behaviour which is to their detriment or to others' detriment. A man's hard-heartedness becomes a weakness for men when it becomes to their detriment, to their woman's detriment, at that equally.
So, Prabhu, is it correct to say that we have both the norm and the variable, but we don't generalize either? Is it? Is that how it works?
Now, the norm is the general state of things, and the variables means, you know, it varies within each woman, within women within a particular race, women of a particular age, women in particular circumstances, so there are variables. Sometimes the traits within women are also found in men. Like that. Sometimes the traits of men who generally don't get so emotionally attached and involved and interfering with the way that they intelligently deal with things, they do the same as women. So therefore they have if you're going to call it a weakness or vulnerability, men have the same vulnerability as a variable. So, you know, we've got to be able to present that. That helps to put it into statement. Therefore, that would mean that sometimes, when there's divorce, it could be the men who have this soft-hearted nature who allow some emotional aspect to override their intelligence, and it could be that their behaviour becomes the fault while the marriage broke up because of the variable. And certain.
So sorry, I've lost the train there. Earlier you were saying that men.
Train pulling up the station. Go on.
Earlier you were saying about the men, if they are not able to have empathy with a woman,
mm-hmm.
that could lead to. That's also weakness.
Yes.
Now, and you can make a statement that sometimes maybe because of that it leads to a divorce too.
That's right.
So there itself, you can say that could be the cause for the divorce. Not necessarily that they have to only become soft-hearted and so their intentions are not plain.
That's right.
So if they're not having empathy,
yeah.
So the woman doesn't feel really cared for, isn't it? Because that's what she wants.
Yes. So, let's see. There's a summarize that in your statement. The way for my brain to kick in. So we've got so men's weakness too little. Emotional empathy. Can also lead to divorce. Isn't it? So too little emotional empathy on the man's weakness, you know, which is their hard-heartedness, can lead to divorce. So therefore, I mean, that also proves that whenever there is divorce, it's not the woman's fault.
As in, it's not only the woman's fault.
Well, yeah, we're saying that because that's how it appears. That's how it's very easy to take that statement from the Bhagavad Gita, you know, from what Prabhupada is saying, you know, is divorce. You know, it's a very it's an easily drawn misuse of that text. Generally, and Prabhupada does use the word generally, separation between husband and wife is due to womanly behaviour. Divorce takes place due to womanly weakness. Now, let's put that in. Let's take the fault of women and let's say it in a different way. That where womanly weakness,
women who are less soft-hearted can also be
it's in the book. Yeah. Where womanly weakness is present within a man or a woman, it can lead to divorce.
Or if women had less soft-heartedness, that will also lead to divorce.
No wonder there's a lot of divorce.
That's, you know, I'm just trying to, you know, balance it. If one goes up, another one comes down. You know what I mean?
I do. What did I say? So
So where womanly weakness is present, in men or women, it can lead to divorce.
Because of soft-heartedness.
Yep. Soft-heartedness in the context that the emotions have overridden the intelligence, which is caused improper behavior. That, you know, when we say a weakness means that someone is prone to do a faulty action. You know, there's a weakness. Or that person may do some faulty action or has done some faulty action. That was a weakness.
So then we can quote Bhagavad Gita here. That is it second chapter Bhagavad Gita?
Bhagavad Gita.
That saying that what is the areas of faults, like from lust you get anger. So that weakness comes in there.
Yep.
So when that sort of weakness comes in, and then your delusion, then memory falls and you fall down.
That's right.
So that is for, Bhagavad Gita says for anybody. So
There's attachment, there's an emotional attachment to something.
Yeah, so that weakness.
There's frustration of the emotional attachment, and it does create a weakness.
Yes.
And where that is present, that's exactly right. Bhagavad Gita 2:62, 61, 62, 3 and 4. So where womanly weakness is present in men and women, it can lead to divorce. And especially in Kali Yuga, everything's so topsy-turvy, mixed up. You know, women wanting to become equal to men means women are becoming like men. You know? And men trying to counteract that, men are becoming like women. So, there's a lot of, we can certainly understand, it should be a bold statement. This statement of Prabhupada is not saying whenever there's divorce, it's generally the woman's fault. That should be made very clear. You know, generally women are soft-hearted, and sometimes the emotional aspect of it can cloud one's intelligence, that can lead to faulty actions, that's called a weakness, that may lead to divorce. If that same quality is there in men, that will also lead to divorce. And certainly, when we use the term weakness for women, it on the spiritual platform, it in no way defines or qualifies their spiritual status. Even if you use the term weakness due to the soft-hearted, in no way does it define the spiritual quality of Radharani, Lakshmi, Draupadi, Sati or Diti that any men should ever feel that they are equal to or above. And when Prabhupada says the statement, women are naturally soft-hearted, men sometimes hard-hearted, one should not think that in terms of trying to make men and women equal. That's not possible. They do have different natures, generally. And these statements, where sometimes the differences between men and women are stated quite clearly by Prabhupada, are properly accepted. They're generally accepted. And someone who says that men and women are equal, it is false. Men can't have babies. There are various differences, and therefore we have to accept that there are differences.
not necessarily at fault unless the difference sometimes leads to improper behavior. And then we say it is a fault. Otherwise, it's just the nature. Alright? So
we can conclude by saying that Prabhupada doesn't mean that woman's weakness, by woman's weakness that men are superior, or that all faults in marriage are due to women.
That's right.
But rather he means that men and women have to work together.
Yeah.
To be, to create harmony and to go to the spiritual goal.
Yes.
That would be, that's what Prabhupada wanted.
Exactly. And he says that. In that chapter, Prabhupada says that, is it that same verse that, you know, the woman is considered half a man's body?
Yeah.
Wait, is that there?
Not the same verse.
What verse is that? Verse 3, according to Vedic conception of family life, the husband gives half his body to his wife, and the wife gives half her body to her husband. In other words, a husband without a wife, well, wife without a husband is incomplete. Again, showing that...
Which verse is that? Same
that verse. Same verse. The fault is not in... The fault... It's not saying that women are generally naturally soft-hearted, which is actually a fault. Nor is it saying that generally men are hard-hearted, which is a fault. It's saying that when men and women don't cooperate, that quality becomes a fault. Mm. Isn't it? Because they both have slightly different nature, which they complement each other. They help each other. The soft-hearted nature of a woman helps the man. They need that empathy. Otherwise, as we stated, the hard-heartedness of a man can lead to divorce. And vice versa. So it's a very good point, Nirmala. Krishna, Devi Dasani.
I think
Prabhupada
also says somewhere that it's in the first three chapters on this statement. But you see that you'll find more women in the temples than men.
Yes.
So they can develop faith in the Lord much easier than...
That's right, yeah. So, and in that way, which is very good, because as we say, it's the other statements Prabhupada makes from, you know, various... When we take an overview of all Prabhupada's statements about this quality, it really does put it in the context. And that again, Peter Luxon, very nice point, that Prabhupada uses the same soft-hearted nature to actually show the greatness, very fortunate position of women, that they naturally become more religiously inclined because they're soft-hearted. You know, that makes them, you know, the religious life, the spiritual life is very attractive to them, more so than men, because of that, you know, hardness of the heart. The religion is all about soft, you know, that for soft-hearted people, same people. So it makes women very. So again, very good point, and it really puts the statement into context. The Prabhupada has not just got this one-sided view that should be bandied about. And in that case, sometimes divorce in ISKCON takes place because the women are sometimes more spiritually inclined than the men. You know, I know of an example of a devotee who comes here regularly, almost daily, who very spiritually inclined, and her partner, you know, they bought a house and everything, and he just left because he didn't have the spirit. He doesn't come here at all. He just didn't want to devote his life to spirituality. He left. So that hard-hearted nature didn't allow him the same natural propensity to be religious. And that led to divorce. So to misquote Prabhupada, which I might say I have seen to be very common in ISKCON, even this one here, about seeing women as, you know, they're the blame, that weak heart that they've got.
Prabhupada you perhaps know, she should wait.
Should never happen, and yet it does.
Perhaps she should wait till this man should raise up.
No, he's gone. He's gone. He's gone. She waited. He's not coming back. Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there. Okay. Very good. Deep meditation. have you?
Yeah.
Does anyone want to see it? Do you want to do it?
I can do it now. But
anyone want to see a quick presentation on?
So I can prepare
my own we're all happy. Yeah. No, you have to go. Yeah. Excellent.
Because
yeah.
That I did long time ago. But this I missed because I was in Mayapur and missed.